Welcome. I am Father Justin. I am an Orthodox priest from Canada, the frozen north, and I have the only English language Orthodox church in Vancouver. Well, we're actually kind of in North Vancouver now, St. John of Shanghai Orthodox Church. When I was asked if I wanted to submit a presentation on doing something regarding the end of the world, I'm like, yes, apocalyptic stuff is awesome. And I wasn't initially intending to do anything on Arthur, but as I thought about it more and more, I thought, well, wait a second. The Arthurian legend, which is kind of the urtext of English literature, is really, like, why does it resonate? Why did it resonate so dramatically with the English people? Because, and I think the answer is, for them, this was the end of the world. You know, if you think about the kind of the origins of Arthur, and I'm going to go into some of the historical details, and I have a historian in our midst, so she may correct me if I get things wrong. But if you think about it, the Roman world was crumbling. And Britain, you know, despite the fact that they resisted the Romans at first, they had been Roman for generations. And now all of a sudden, their world was falling to pieces as the Saxons were invading. And so for them, this was the end of the world. But more than that, as I'm thinking about, you know, what to present on with regards to the theme, one of the things that came out of the theme was, well, we need some hope. You know, especially when the end of the world is coming, you need something to hope for. And as I thought about sources of hope, like personal hope in my life, when I get to the end of this, I kind of want to make it a lot more personal. Is the Arthurian legend was key for me in so many ways growing up. Now, I am not an expert on all things Arthurian. My entry into the Arthurian legend wasn't even like John Steinbeck's, who had a cut down version of Caxton, written in the Old English, that he read when he was a kid. That was the version that was near and dear to his heart. No, I just read some. I don't even know now, looking back on it. I just read some. Thing that was, an abridged version for kids of Arthurian legend. But it stuck with me. And more than that, it has overflowed in all sorts of other areas, which I want to get to in my life. So first of all, let's back up. Let's take a look at the history and the sources. Because the title of my talk is The Deaths of Arthur. And the original reason that I got into this was, I know a little bit, because I love Arthurian legend, I love this stuff, but I do know that there are multiple versions of the death of Arthur. And I suspected that they would be slightly different, I suspected they would be more different than I found that they actually were, going back. Oh, and I should also say, the sort of historical, or the main focus of my talk is not going to be on modern adaptations of Arthur. There's a reason for that. I detest them. Almost all of them. Now, that being said, I do love Monty Python and the Holy Grail. But I have to say, it's emblematic of what our most modern adaptations of Arthur end up being. Parodies. You know, even T.H. White, who obviously is sympathetic to Arthur, and who I referenced in my last talk when I came here, it was about transformation. He's taking the Arthurian corpus and he can't quite bring himself to treat it seriously. He is a serious person, so it ends up being somewhat serious, but there's all these little whimsical things like Merlin living backwards and hedgehogs singing Clementine and things like that. And I think that's a problem. And I think if we go back to the origins of this legend, that we will find that, and in particular, origins of the death of the story of the death of Arthur, which is kind of not only a very personal end of the world, but as I say, an end of an age. That we will find that there's a lot more to be gained, a lot more that we can value and we can appreciate and we can mine for ourselves to actually sustain us in the time of troubles. So, going back to the beginning, did Arthur exist? The answer is, we have actually no idea. In the Annals of Wales, one of the earliest texts that we have, kind of, sort of, an annal, which is basically, you know, just like a whole series of, it was this year and this happened. Very short statements. He's mentioned two times. In the 72nd year, which is about AD 516, he's mentioned in the context of the Battle of Badon, in which it says, Arthur carried the cross of our Lord Jesus Christ on his shoulders for 3 days and three nights, and the Britons were victors. And the Battle of Badon is an historical event, and it was a moment at which the Britons actually did seem to drive back the Saxons, at least for a time. And then in the year 93, about the year 537, it says, the strife of Camlann occurred, in which Arthur and Medrot, otherwise known as Mordred, fell, and there was death in Britain and Ireland. So this is great, because these are fairly early years, right? 516, 537, they should be contemporaneous with Arthur. The problem is, the Annals of Wales were... we see them in the context of the next major historical source about Arthur, which is Nennius, or maybe Nennius, depending on whether or not you buy his authorship of the text. I have no problem with the idea of Nennius being an actual person who compiled stuff, so I'm going to refer to it as Nennius, which is about the year 800 or so. So what we see in the Annals of Wales, which, as far as we know, is a 12th century copy of a 10th century original. And given the context that we find it in, compiled with Nennius, it's not impossible that this could have been inserted back in. So we don't, even though this is great, nice, really early evidence for Arthur as a historical figure, there's another contemporary source, one that is actually, we can identify more contemporaneously with Arthur, Gildas, who writes on the ruin and conquest of Britain, which is essentially a homily. So it's a big, long sermon telling the Britons where they're going wrong and why they're going wrong. We date it to, what did he say, 44 years after the Battle of Badon. So this is written by somebody who, at least on some level, should have been contemporaneous with Arthur. And he does mention figures who show up in the Arthurian legend. For example, he mentions Ambrosius Aurelianus, but he doesn't mention Arthur. He mentions the Battle of Badon, but he doesn't mention Arthur. And then the question arises, well, wait a sec, if this contemporary of Arthur's, who's talking about the ruin and conquest of Britain, isn't mentioning Arthur, why not? Maybe Arthur didn't exist. It could be that it wasn't relevant to his homiletical purposes. Maybe, but then if Ambrosius Aurelius is mentioned, why not mention Arthur? And this actually occurred to St. Gildas's 12th century hagiographer. His explanation was Gildas didn't mention Arthur because Arthur killed his brother. And so he's really annoyed by that. And so, you know, he's just not going to mention that, you know, just kind of overlook Arthur. Okay, maybe. Sounds to me like possibly an explanation after the fact. The next historical source, and the last one I'll mention in terms of historicity, is Nennius. And he wrote around AD, around AD 800, 850. His preface dates itself as 858. The usual date given for it is actually 828. There's also a reference in one of the lines to something that's in the 500s. So it's quite possible that he was actually compiling sources, as he says. Like he says, his motive is to preserve in Latin the history of his own people. Compiled partly from writings and monuments of the ancient inhabitants of Britain, partly from the annals of the Romans, I'm quoting actually from Nennius, and the chronicles of the sacred fathers Isidore, Hieronymus, Jerome, Prosper, Eusebius, and from the history of the Scots and Saxons, although our enemies, not following my own inclinations, but to the best of my ability, obeying the commands of my seniors, because he was indignant that the name of my own people, formerly famous and distinguished, should sink into oblivion. So in Nennius, we actually have quite a bit about Arthur. So, and he's obviously interested in preserving what he's found from a variety of sources, including his own British traditions. There's not a lot about Arthur and Nennius, but he does say, after the death of St. Germanus, the Saxons greatly increased in number, and then, this is kind of the main quote about Arthur, then it was that the magnanimous Arthur, with all the kings and military force of Britain, fought against the Saxons. And though there were many more noble than himself, yet he was 12 times chosen than their commander and was as often conqueror. And then he lists a whole bunch of battles. Interestingly, the eighth battle, he says that Arthur bore the image of the Holy Virgin, the Mother of God, upon his shoulders, and through the power of our Lord Jesus Christ and the Holy Mary, put the Saxons to flight and pursued them the whole day with great slaughter. This actually seems to correspond to what we saw in the Welsh annals, right? In that case, it was talking about him having the cross on his shoulders. Shoulders, by the way, in Welsh is also very close to the word for shield. So it's quite possible that he wasn't actually carrying some image of Mary around on his shoulders. It was more likely he had the cross on his shield, or an image of the Virgin Mary on his shield. And then he references the Battle of Badon. The 12th was a most severe contest when Arthur penetrated to the hill of Badon. And in this engagement, 940 fell by his hand alone. And in all these engagements, the Britons were successful, for no strength can avail against the will of the Almighty. And that's all he has to say about Arthur. he doesn't even actually record his death. The aftermath that he notes, in the aftermath of Arthur, he says, the more the Saxons were vanquished, the more they sought for new supplies of Saxons from Germany, so that kings, commanders, and military bands were invited from almost every province. So, okay, here we have then more or less most of the historical information that we can find, the early historical information. There's later, like Welsh tales and stuff that get written, and those are hard to date because some of them are oral. I think you can make an argument kind of either way in terms of the historicity of Arthur. But in some respects, it doesn't really matter. What matters is that by the time of Nennius, by the 800s, as the Britons are looking back on their own history, one of the key things that they see is there was this great struggle against the Saxons, which is very clearly hooked into the preservation of Romanized Britain. And Arthur, who seems to have been Dux Ballorum, a war duke, he becomes emblematic of this struggle against the Saxons. And so he then is embedded in this tradition, which then gives rise to, you know, various Welsh tales about him, preserved among the remnants of the British people, which then gets taken up in what I'm going to call the transition between the historical and the literary figure of Arthur, Geoffrey of Monmouth. So Geoffrey of Monmouth wrote the history of the kings of Britain. He wrote just after the Norman conquest of England. And here we start to get Arthur as a literary figure, very clearly as a literary figure, because in Geoffrey of Monmouth's telling, it isn't just a struggle against the Saxons. Arthur actually goes down and attacks Rome and conquers Rome itself. And Geoffrey was super influential, partly because he's writing at a key moment in British history. The Norman conquest has just happened. The Saxons have been defeated. It's a good time to trot out the Saxons as the enemies again. And he's taking what has been handed down to him and kind of spinning a tale. Like, really spinning a tale. Like, despite the fact that it's super influential, he's writing in Latin, he's writing at a moment when, at a key moment in British history, he's writing in a way that is accessible to the Norman conquerors in both England and France, this is important, and he's a tale teller. His contemporaries recognized him as a tale teller. William of Newburgh condemns Geoffrey for weaving ridiculous figments of imagination around historical events that were recorded by the venerable Bede, and cloaking these old British fables about Arthur with the honorable name of history by presenting them in Latin. You know, anything you say in Latin sounds very, you know, authoritative. It's like, so. It's interesting that one of the possible motives he ascribes to Geoffrey for doing so is to please the Britons, most of whom are known to be so primitive that they are said to still be awaiting the return of Arthur and will not suffer themselves to hear that he is dead. That's actually a really interesting observation. The Britons are still around, the British people, and they still treasure this notion that Arthur is still alive. Kind of like, I don't know, Elvis or something like that. So William of Newburgh, when he's looking at what Geoffrey seems to be doing, he's getting mad at him for doing it. the one motive he can come up with is, well, you know, people like stories about Arthur. Why do they like stories about Arthur? And that, I think, again, is a key. Why? Why is it so important that Arthur isn't dead or might not be dead? One other story I really love about a contemporary who really obviously really doesn't like Geoffrey of Monmouth's history of the kings of Britain. He has this story about this guy who can see demons. And he says, when he was harassed beyond endurance by these unclean spirits, St. John's gospel was placed in his lap, and they all vanished immediately, flying away like so many birds. If the gospel were afterwards removed, and the history of the kings of Britain by Geoffrey of Monmouth was put there in its place just to see what would happen, the demons would alight all over his body and on the books too, staying there longer than usual, being even more demanding. So not everybody was a fan of Geoffrey of Monmouth and his history of the kings of Britain, especially those weird bits about Arthur. Interestingly as well, to me, I'm a huge C.S. Lewis fan, it was interesting to hear Lewis also condemns Geoffrey of Monmouth. Lewis is, of course, a medievalist. His most famous scholarly work is The Allegory of Love, which is about courtly love. And he has this to say about Geoffrey, which I have to read in its fullness because it's great, classic Lewis polemic. Geoffrey, of course, is important for the historians of the Arthurian legend. But since the interest of those historians has seldom lain chiefly in literature, they have not always remembered to tell us that he is an author of mediocre talent and no taste. In the Arthurian parts of his work, the lion's share falls to the insufferable rigmarole of Merlin's prophecies and to the foreign conquests of Arthur. These latter, of course, are at once the least historical and the least mythical thing about Arthur. If there was a real Arthur, he did not conquer Rome. The annals of senseless and monotonously successful aggression are dreary enough reading even when true. When blatantly, stupidly false, they are unendurable. But to talk a bit more about Geoffrey of Monmouth's coverage, if you will, of this. In Geoffrey, we actually get a lot of the elements of Arthur and his death that show up in the later literature. First of all, the causes of Arthur's death are Mordred's betrayal. Mordred here is Arthur's nephew. He's left in charge during Arthur's Roman campaign. So Arthur's off conquering the Romans. And then while he's doing that, Mordred rebels and actually tries to marry... marries Guinevere. And then we also have here, as kind of the other cause of Arthur's death, civil war. Interestingly, this notion of civil war is also there in Nennius. Nennius it's also there in Nennius, obviously. Here in this, in Geoffrey and Monmouth's version, Arthur dies fighting his fellow Britons and a collection of enemies. The Saxons still figure. So there's a little bit of the civil war in Nennius, but it's much more important in Geoffrey of Monmouth. There's a little bit of that internecine strife, but here in Geoffrey of Monmouth, it kind of comes to the forefront. So Arthur dies fighting his fellow Britons, and a collection of enemies, primarily Saxons, but also Scots, Picts, Irish, and the others. You know, this could possibly be read as a justification for the Norman conquest. You know, this Saxon kingdom with its Britons, they're always fighting with one another, and that was what enabled us to like get in there and like take over, right? Maybe that's part of what's going on here. So we also have some of the aftermath. That shows up in the literary history here already. Guinevere, known as Guanhamara, Guinevere sounds way better, flees to a convent to escape after she's but she's willingly married Mordred, and so now she when Arthur shows up and is going to like attack Mordred, that's when she flees to a convent. This will show up later in the expanded tradition. Arthur is mortally wounded, and interestingly, here we have kind of the first historical or respectable literary account of him being carried to the Isle of Avalon to be cured. Interesting tension there. On the one hand, Arthur's mortally wounded. On the other hand, he's taken to the Isle of Avalon to be cured. Which is it? Is it a mortal wound? Like he's dead, going to be dead? Or is it, I guess you could say, well, it was potentially mortal, right? We also have a number of other kind of beginnings of what subsequently becomes taken up by the French and becomes the matter of Britain. I would try to say that in French, but my French is terrible. So, but there, we have the theme of freedom. Uther, as we know as Uther Pendragon, on defeating the Saxons, it's a great story actually, he's really sick, and so he can't actually get up and lead his troops, so they actually carry him on a litter, and he defeats the Saxons. And so he says at that point, victory to me half dead is better than to be safe and sound and vanquished, for to die with honor is preferable to living in disgrace. So this theme of freedom is showing up here. Mordred's betrayal now is showing up. We didn't have this in Nennius. It was, again, primarily Arthur versus the Saxons. But now we have Mordred on the scene, and Mordred is no longer fighting with Arthur. He's now fighting against Arthur. I mean, I guess you could say that that entry in the annals could be read either way, but it seems like in the Welsh annals, Mordred is on Arthur's side. Now Mordred is clearly not on Arthur's side. He's left in charge because he's Arthur's kinsman, although here he's in this tradition, he's his nephew, not as it later becomes his son. We have the theme of Guinevere's infidelity, although in this case it's with Mordred. And then we have this civil war, which Geoffrey roundly condemns. O foolish nation, oppressed with the weight of your abominable wickedness, why did you and your insatiable thirst after civil wars so weaken yourself by domestic confusions that whereas formerly you brought distant kingdoms under your yoke, now like a good vineyard degenerated and turned to bitterness, you cannot defend your country, your wives, and children against your enemies? So he's condemning this notion of civil war, which weakened Britain and allowed their enemies to triumph over them, which again is something that shows up later. But it's actually perhaps that the notion that it enables their enemies to triumph over them is perhaps most emphasized here in Geoffrey of Monmouth. What he does later on, as he's going through this history of the kings of Britain, he has like within a few years. Everything's fallen apart. But other things that are also really interesting here. This is where, and I think this is another reason why this moment with Geoffrey of Monmouth is like a key moment in the development of the Arthurian tradition, is it's emerging just as the code of chivalry is emerging. So we have an example of the code of chivalry in the Song of Roland, which to fear God, the knight's code of chivalry is they should fear God and maintain his church, serve the liege lord with valor and faith, protect the weak and defenseless, give succor to widows and orphans, refrain from the wanton giving of offense, to live by honor and for glory, to despise pecuniary reward, to fight for the welfare of all, to obey those placed in authority over them, to guard the honor of fellow knights, to eschew unfairness, meanness, and deceit, to keep faith, to at all times to speak the truth, to persevere to the end in any enterprise begun, to respect the honor of women, never to refuse a challenge from an equal, and never to turn your back upon a foe. That's all in the Song of Roland, but we see elements of that. We see, for example, a single combat between Arthur and Flollo, where they're both on horseback, or they're initially on horseback, with lances, and then one or both of them get unhorsed and they end up like fighting with swords. Looks an awful lot like what we come to expect subsequently in the Arthurian tradition. Similarly, we have tournaments here. There's a three-day tournament at the coronation, prizes given to out on the fourth, which included military men composed a kind of diversion in imitation of a fight on horseback, and the ladies, placed in sportive manner, darted their amorous glances at the courtiers, the more to encourage them. So we have a lot of elements here that are going to become deeply and really inextricably intertwined in the Arthurian tradition. Because what do we think of when we think of King Arthur? We think of King Arthur and his knights and the Round Table and the chivalrous quests that they go on. That at least was my experience of Arthur as a kid. And this whole notion of chivalry is really like super important, becomes really important. And I want to return to that a bit later. But as I say, Geoffrey of Monmouth ends up being super influential. It inspires a whole range of imaginative elaborations, most notably the addition of Lancelot in the French tradition. The French start to write in this kind of courtly love tradition that I referenced before, that Lewis wrote this whole book about, The Allegory of Love. And end up with this prose cycle about Arthur, which has Lancelot, the quest for the Holy Grail, and Mort Artu, which is this whole prose cycle becomes taken up later on in Mallory as the French book, as the French book says, is a common refrain in Mallory. And then we have a couple of English poems. There's a 14th century English alliterative poem called Mort Arthur, and a 14th century stanzaic poem, Le Mort Arthur. At the very least, the English alliterative poem seems to have been an important text for our next major author, and really the definitive author on Arthurian legend, Sir Thomas Malory. So we finally got to Sir Thomas Malory's Le Morte d'Arthur probably wasn't intended to be called Le Morte d'Arthur. A lot of elements of Malory's text were actually edited by his printer slash publisher, William Caxton. It was actually one of the very first books printed on a printing press in England. So really important book. Caxton had one of the things he did was introduce much smaller chapter divisions. Apparently he figured people didn't have the attention span to have long chapters. So and he also rearranged the text quite a bit. We now have in 1930s, I think, around about that time, we discovered a manuscript in Winchester that is probably Malory's original manuscript, called the Winchester Manuscript, creatively. Apparently they even have evidence that it was at Caxton's publishing house or printing press, because there's ink stains on it that you can match. but Caxton heavily edits it, but it this becomes Malory's Morte d'Arthur is huge. First of all, Malory has a lot more to work with, because he's got this French tradition and this English tradition. As I say, it sounds like he started with the English alliterative Morte d'Arthur, which focuses largely on the campaigns in Rome, and then expands that till he's got this huge two-volume work. Now, I have to admit, I don't know Malory that well. I got Arthur in translation, if you will, cut down. And when I did finally start to engage with Malory when I was doing my studies in English literature, I found him kind of boring, especially at the beginning, because Malory's really fascinated by jousting. He has all these really detailed blow-by-blow accounts, and they got up on their horses, they shouldered their lances, they ran at one another, and the lances splintered, and they got a new set of lances, and they ran at one another again, and those lances splintered, and they ran at one another again, and this time they unhorsed each other and got off and started hacking themselves, and this happened and that happened. Actually, I would really like to see a movie made that is faithful to Malory, because you have literally blow-by-blow descriptions of the battles, and some of them are pretty amazing. When we get to the death of Arthur and Malory, it's a pretty amazing account. I got to read that section to you just because it's so awesome. But Malory actually is a really complicated story. He weaves a really complicated tale, and so that the causes of Arthur's death in Malory are actually quite, they're worked all the way through the text. So there's a reason, I think, that Caxton called it The Death of Arthur. It's because the fall of Arthur, the death of Arthur, the fall of the Round Table, the destruction of that whole world, was something that was obviously really on Malory's mind, and he really preps for it. It's not something that comes out of nowhere. So if I had to list the causes of Arthur's death in Malory, here's the list. The hatred of Mordred and Agravaine. Sir Mordred and Sir Agravaine are kind of they hate Guinevere and Lancelot with a passion. It produced a great anger and unhap that stinted not till the flower of chivalry of all the world was destroyed and slain, and all was long upon two unhappy knights, the which were named Agravaine and Sir Mordred, that were brethren unto Sir Gawain. For this Sir Agravaine and Sir Mordred had ever a privy hate unto the queen, Dame Guinevere, and to Sir Lancelot, and daily and nightly they ever watched upon Sir Lancelot, says. So he really, that's, if there's kind of one thing you wanted to point to, that's a fairly clear quote that it's them that are at fault. But then there's obviously a number of other things that flow from that, and even other things that are not connected to that. So why do they hate Lancelot and Guinevere? Well, probably there's multiple reasons in the text, but the obvious one is Lancelot and Guinevere are sleeping together. Guinevere is being unfaithful to Arthur. It's interesting how Mallory treats this. He doesn't go into a lot of detail, of course, and even at some points seems to throw it into question, but then he makes it really clear at the end, no, they were sleeping together, and their love for one another was an adulterous love, and Arthur kind of turns a blind eye to it. There's a really interesting quote I have to read to you about that, but it's tied into the next major flaw, and this one is actually really huge, and in fact, for Mallory, I think I'm not sure if it's deliberate, but it's fairly clear that this is a really massive flaw in the whole kind of medieval system, which is to say that in the medieval system, if your honor is impugned, you get to do trial by combat, and Lancelot is just like single-handedly, hands down, the best knight of his age. Nobody can defeat Lancelot, period, end of story. So what happens if you accuse Lancelot of sleeping with Guinevere? Well, when King Arthur is approached with this, he actually recommends that they capture, that if this is true, they capture Lancelot in the act. Why? I would be loath to begin such a thing, but I might have proofs upon it. For Lancelot is an hardy knight, and ye all know he is the best knight among us all. But if he be taken with the deed, he will fight with him that bringeth up the noise. And I know no knight that is able to match him. Take with you sure fellowship, for I warn ye shall find him white, deadly. Right? And Lancelot confirms this flaw in the whole system, because when he's caught in the act, like, he's actually in the room surrounded by Mordred, Angravaine, and like the 12 knights who are with them. And he says to them, go you all from the chamber door and make not such crying and such manner of slander as ye do. For I promise you by my knighthood, and ye will depart and make no more noise. I shall as tomorrow appear for you all before the king. And then let it be seen which of you all, other else ye all, that will accuse me of treason. And there I shall answer you as a knight should, that hither I came to the queen for no manner of malengine, and that I will prove and make it good upon you with my hands. Whereupon, and this is totally something that should be in the Mallory movie, they actually attack him. He's completely defenseless. He doesn't have his armor with him. So he bars the door, then lets it open just enough to grab one of them, pull him in, kill him, and take his armor, put it on, and then he proceeds to kill all of them except Mordred. Totally awesome action movie, but anyhow. But he's totally willing to lie, interestingly, and just to protect the honor of the queen. So that, like, if you look at the code of chivalry, there's a couple of things at work here that are working against one another. And in fact, he then, when Arthur feels like, okay, I got to burn her at the stake, because they've obviously caught her. He actually swoops in with his knights and attacks and rescues Guinevere, bears her off. And in the fight, there's like so many people pressed around. Two of the knights who love him above all, Sir Gareth and Sir Gaheris, who are brothers of Sir Gawain, who's like the second greatest knight, they get killed. Because they actually said, we won't fight against Sir Lancelot, we love him, and we're going to guard the queen, but we will not wear our armor. And so Lancelot gallops in, like, lays about left and right, kills them amongst like all the other people he's killed, and makes off with Guinevere. This becomes the next huge thing that is a flaw in the system. Family ties gone wrong. So Sir Gawain's grudge now bears a grudge against Sir Lancelot, because Lancelot has killed three of his brothers, the two that I mentioned here, and Agravain was also his brother. So Arthur actually wants to forgive Lancelot. He wants to forgive Guinevere. He wants this to be at an end. In fact, he says, and this is one of those quotes I really have to read, Merci Jesus, says the king. Why slew he Sir Gareth and Sir Gaheris? For I dare say, as for Sir Gareth, he loved Sir Lancelot above all men earthly. That is truth, said some knights, but they were slain in the hurtling of as Sir Lancelot thrang in the thick of the press. And as they were unharmed, he smote them, and wist not whom that he smote, and so unhappily they were slain. The death of them, said Arthur, will cause the greatest mortal war that ever was. I am sure, wist Sir Gawain, that Sir Gareth was slain, I should never have rest of him till I had destroyed Sir Lancelot's kin and himself both, other else he to destroy me. And therefore, said King, wit you well, my heart was never so heavy as it is now, for much more am I sorrier for my good knight's loss than for the loss of my fair queen. For queens I might have enow, but such a fellowship of good knights shall never be together in no company. So, fascinating comment, like, especially given what Tennyson later on does with this. Tennyson, in his Idylls of the King, has Arthur being this, like, paragon of virtue. Here, Arthur is, like, Mordred is actually Arthur's son by his half-sister before he marries Guinevere. So he is faithful to Guinevere, but he's not a virgin at that point. But in Tennyson, Arthur keeps saying, don't call Mordred my kinsman, and he's really pure. And he's totally in love with Guinevere. That's like kind of the main thing that is, if you read Tennyson's poem Guinevere, that comes across. Arthur really loves her, and he's heartbroken. But here, he's more heartbroken by the destruction of his fellowship of goodly knights than he is, you know, by Guinevere. Because, you know, I could have another queen. Yeah, lots of women want me. In Malory, what began with a war against the Saxons and then in Geoffrey of Monmouth became kind of this mix between civil war and war against the Saxons and the Picts and like all of the enemies, is now simply and entirely a civil war. Arthur is at war with Mordred. Lancelot eventually leaves, goes to France, but Sir Gareth won't let well enough alone. He says, Arthur, you got to go fight Lancelot in France. So Arthur says, okay, fine, I'll leave Mordred in charge. He's my son, after all. He goes off to fight Lancelot. And while he's off fighting Lancelot, Mordred forges letters saying the king is dead. Easier to do back then when you don't have the internet. holds a parliament, gets everybody together, and Arthur gets word, has to return, and has to do an amphibious landing, where he's opposed by Mordred. Sir Gawain is slain in that, and interestingly, he then says that he wants Lancelot to know that he is sorry for all of this, and he wants Lancelot to come and pray over his grave. Recommends that Arthur wait for Lancelot to come, because Lancelot will come. Arthur ends up not waiting for Lancelot to come. He wants to. In fact, he actually is in the middle of negotiating a treaty with Mordred, where he's going to give up like half his kingdom to him. But of course, tensions are still high. And so he's got his party, Mordred's got his party, and both of them have said to their men, if you see a drawn sword, attack. And what happens is one of the knights gets bit on the heel by a grass snake or something. He whips out his sword to kill the snake, and they all attack. And Arthur knows that he's going to, knows now that he's going to die. Because the whole reason why he was waiting for Lancelot was because there was this prophecy that if he fought Mordred, he would die. So he now knows he's going to die. And he looks around and he sees all his knights are slain. Everybody. Like, there's Mordred and he has two knights and that's it. Everybody else is dead. Hang on, I just got to find the... Okay, there we go. So he looks around saying, I wish I knew where Mordred was. He's the cause of all this. I just want to kill him. Then he sees him. And then the king got his spear in both his hands and ran towards Sir Mordred, crying, Traitor, now is thy death day come. And when Sir Mordred heard Sir Arthur, he ran until him with his sword drawn in his hand. And there Arthur smote Sir Mordred under the shield with the point of his spear throughout the body, more than a fathom. So the spear goes right through his body, like, like it sticks out the other side. And when Sir Mordred felt that he had his death wound, he thrust himself with the might that he had up to the bur of King Arthur's spear. And right so he smote his father Arthur with his sword, holding in both his hands on the side of his head, that the sword pierced the helmet and the brain pan. And therewith Sir Mordred fell stark dead to the earth, and the noble Arthur fell in a swoon to the earth, and there he swooned oftentimes. This is the death of Arthur, as narrated by Mallory. Totally awesome for an action movie. It's like you could just see him dragging the spear into himself and then both hands smashing him on the head. So his brain is like partly exposed. So then Mallory is interesting because while he does have Arthur being taken off to the Isle of Avalon, to be healed of this wound, he has to get Bedivere to throw his sword away first, Excalibur. And Bedivere is like, oh, this is a beautiful sword. I just can't throw it away. It's like twice. And Arthur knows, because he's like, nothing happened, just like a bunch of waves. And Arthur's like, no, something's going to happen. You got to throw it away. And finally, he throws it away, and the hand comes out, waves it thrice, and draws it under the water. And Sir Bedivere goes back to Arthur, tells him, and Arthur is like, oh, okay, yeah, you finally did it. And, you know, it took so long, I'm going to die now, basically. It's like my wound's already cold. And in fact, one of the three queens in the boat says, oh, you're like, why did you take so long? And then he's taken to the Isle of Avalon, but the very next day, Sir Bedivere, who's the last one alive, finds in this hermitage a hermit mourning over this grave, and like three women came and took this person to his grave, and it's like, oh, it's Arthur. He's dead. He still allows for the fact that some people, but it's really clear in Mallory, Arthur is actually dead. So what's the end of this? And I see I'm running out of time, so I haven't even got to Tennyson. But what is the end of all this for Mallory and then for me, very briefly? For Mallory, Guinevere does go to the monastery. Lancelot finds her, wants her to come away with him. Obviously, she doesn't. She wants to actually repent. So she is embracing monasticism for the salvation of her soul. Lancelot, likewise. When he realizes that she really wants to be a monk, she's not going to come away with him, says, I'm going to be a monk too. She's like, no, there's no way. Lancelot, hey, when have you known me to fail at anything? She says. So he too embraces monasticism. He wants her to kiss him. She says, nope, not going to do that. So she's like really serious about this, and he is too. In fact, he ends up burying her. He becomes a priest monk. He ends up burying her. And then after he buries her, he basically stops eating and wastes away and dies. But he buries her next to Arthur. So one of the things that really struck me about kind of reviewing all this is a very Christian tradition. We have prayers for the dead. We have monasticism. Lancelot, at one point, when he's like wanting to make amends for something, he says, "Oh, I like found a whole bunch of monasteries, like here and here and here. Like every like 10 miles or so, he's going to found a monastery to. It's to atone for killing Sir Gawain's brothers. But more than that, one of the things that kind of echoes in this for me." Is a really key question for all of us as we face our end is how do we face it? We're all going to die. We're all up against unbelievably insurmountable odds. How can we possibly manage this? And one of the things that I found, not only just reading Arthur in my childhood, but also imbibing Arthur indirectly through Lewis and Tolkien, who I really wanted to go into this part, but I can't. Lewis and Tolkien both were actually really interested in Arthurian legend. Tolkien actually wrote a poem, The Fall of Arthur, an alliterative poem, didn't finish it. Because then he got distracted by Lord of the Rings. And Lewis was an expert in all sorts of things Arthurian. But neither of them wrote about it. Well, Lewis did sort of tangentially in That Hideous Strength, of course. But that whole chivalric code infuses their work. The Return of the King, Aragorn, his lordly speeches, Lewis with... Reap a cheap and like totally willing to go up against a dragon all by himself, right? This kind of heroic last stand had a huge impact on me as a kid and growing up. Because as I started to see my father engaged in things where fights that he couldn't win, but he needed to do this for honor, for goodness, for the sake of what is true and right and holy. My very first short story, which is terrible, but was about a descendant of King Arthur who gets involved in a glorious last stand against William the Conqueror and dies, and everybody dies. So which is also a very Arthurian thing. But as I grew up and sort of this sort of notion was embedded in me. And I ended up going to university and starting to like struggle as a Christian in a world that's fairly hostile to Christianity. The thing that kept me going was it doesn't matter whether you can win or not. What matters is that we defend what is true and right and good and holy, that we offer our lives. We're all going to die. So it's not a question of avoiding death. It's a question of how do we die? And when I finally studied Hamlet, which is, I think, another echo of Arthurian legend, the noble prince who's wronged by a very, very powerful relative, his uncle Claudius. And he spends, like, most of the play trying to use his madness to, like, get out of, from under Claudius's control, because Claudius holds all the cards. The turning point in that play, and we'll finish this with this. The turning point in that play is the fight at sea. Like he's on his way to be killed with Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. There's this pirate ship that comes randomly out of nowhere. And he leaps onto the pirate ship and the two ships are apart. And it's like completely random. Comes out of nowhere. But that's actually really important. He says... About that, to his friend Horatio, our indiscretion sometimes serves us well when our deep plots do pall. And that should teach us that there's a divinity that shapes our end, rough hew them how we will. And when he's going up against Laertes in this, what he knows is probably a rigged duel, he's probably going to his death, he says again to Horatio, who's like telling him, no, this is gonna be bad, you're gonna die. So it's not a wit. We defy augury. There's a special providence in the fall of a sparrow. If it be now, if death be now, 'tis not to come. If it be not to come, it will be now. If it be not now, yet it will come. The readiness is all. How do we prepare for our end? We need to prepare by living for something higher than ourselves. And I think that code can be found in what gets attached to the end of the world as Britain knew it. And the last heroic stand of Arthur against the darkness.